In episode 3, we climbed from the die to the rack, the accelerators, the high bandwidth memory, and the networking that fuse thousands of chips into one coherent machine. This episode, we ask where that rack physically lives, and the thesis I'll open with is that the binding constraint has moved out of the silicon entirely and into the building and the grid around it. I'll take power density, because it is the hinge the whole episode turns on. A rack is the standardized cabinet that holds the servers, and for the entire cloud era, a normal rack drew roughly 10 to 15 kilowatts, kilowatt being 1,000 watts, and that heat was carried off by blowing cold air through the cabinet. The whole design language of the data center, raised floors, hot aisle, cold aisle containment, big computer room air handlers, was built on that assumption. Now look at the reference design for this generation, NVIDIA's GB200 NVL72. 72 Blackwell graphics processors and 36 Grace processors in a single cabinet drawing around 130 to 140 kilowatts, of which the large majority must be removed by liquid, not air. That is not incrementally more than the old rack. It is roughly 10 times the density in the same footprint. And the trajectory steepens. The Vera Rubin generation, the NVL144 landing in the second half of 2026, pushes rack draw toward the 180 to 200 kilowatt band, and operators are already planning campuses around a future 500 kilowatt to 1 megawatt rack, MW being megawatt, 1 million watts. Once power density jumps by an order of magnitude, every downstream assumption breaks. How you cool it, how you wire it, how many you fit in a building, how much grid you must secure. Density is the forcing function, and my co-lecturer will take what it breaks first, which is cooling.
I'll take the cooling transition, because it is the most concrete physical consequence of that density jump. Air is simply a poor medium for moving heat. It works fine at 10 kilowatts, strains around 40, and falls apart past 50. And you cannot blow enough cold air across a 140 kilowatt rack to keep the chips from cooking. So the industry is marching through three stages. Stage one is the air cooling we just described. Stage two, happening at scale right now, is direct-to-chip liquid cooling, sometimes called DLC. You run a coolant, usually a water-glycol mix, through metal cold plates sitting directly on the hottest dies, the graphics processors and the processors. The heat exchange happens at the coolant distribution unit, the CDU, which isolates the facility water loop from the clean technology loop running to the racks. In-rack and in-row CDUs now scale into the megawatt plus range per unit. Alongside them sit rear door heat exchangers, liquid-cooled radiators bolted to the back of a cabinet for hybrid retrofits. Stage three, still emerging, is immersion, submerging whole boards in a dielectric fluid that does not conduct electricity. The crossover is the headline. Liquid-cooled capacity is reported to have matched air in 2025 and is projected to roughly double air by the end of 2026, an enormous retrofit problem, since most existing halls were plumbed for air. The supply chain is consolidating violently around this. Vertiv leads CDUs with an estimated low double-digit share, with Schneider Electric, Rittal, Stoltz, and Boyd rounding the top five. The specialist tier is Asetek, CoolIT, LiquidStack, Green Revolution Cooling, Chilldyne, and Motivair. And the money confirms the thesis. Eaton is reported to be acquiring Boyd Thermal for around $9.5 billion, Ecolab buying CoolIT for roughly $4.75 billion, Daikin taking Chilldyne. The plumbing has become strategic.
I'll go one layer deeper into the thermal stack, because cold plates are only the visible half, and the facility-side plumbing is where the engineering pain concentrates. Below the CDU sit two heat rejection paths. The traditional one is the chiller plant with a cooling tower, which rejects heat to the atmosphere by evaporating water. Efficient on energy, brutal on water, and the reason data center water draw became a political story. The alternative is the dry cooler, or air-cooled chiller, which rejects heat with fans and refrigerant, and consumes almost no water but burns more electricity, and performs worse on hot days. That is precisely the water-for-power trade my co-lecturer flagged, and at the rack densities we are now discussing, it pushes operators toward warm water cooling, running the loop at higher supply temperatures, sometimes above 45 degrees Celsius, so the facility can reject heat without mechanical chilling for much of the year. On immersion, distinguish the two flavors. Single phase, where the dielectric fluid stays liquid and is pumped through a heat exchanger,
and two-phase, where the fluid boils on the chip and condenses above it, which is thermally superior but tangled in fluid chemistry concerns. Several perfluorinated coolants face environmental and regulatory pressure, which has slowed two-phase adoption. The unglamorous bottleneck inside all of this is the fluid network itself. Quick disconnect couplings, manifolds, leak detection, and filtration. The parts that must be perfect, because a leak over an energized board is catastrophic. Which is exactly why Vertiv paid roughly $1 billion for the flushing and commissioning specialist PurgeRite, and why coupling makers like CPC and Staubli quietly became critical suppliers. The lesson for the interview is that the cooling transition is not a single product swap. It is a replumbing of the entire building, from the chip surface out to the cooling tower. And every link in that chain has its own scarce specialist.
I'll cover where this capacity is physically landing, because geography is now a first-class constraint, not an afterthought. For two decades, the default hub was Northern Virginia, Loudoun County, so-called Data Center Alley, which still carries the largest concentration on Earth, but it has effectively run into a power wall. The local utility, Dominion, has interconnection commitments stretching years out, and new large loads there now wait in line behind a queue measured in gigawatts. So the map is redrawing toward wherever stranded or fast deployable power exists. Central Texas, on the ERCOT grid, has become a magnet precisely because that grid is independent, permits faster, and sits next to abundant natural gas, which is why OpenAI's Stargate flagship landed in Abilene and why xAI built Colossus in Memphis on the neighboring system. Other surges are following power and cheap land into Ohio, Indiana, Wyoming, the Phoenix Corridor in Arizona, despite its water stress, and increasingly the Gulf Coast near gas supply. Internationally, the same logic drives builds toward the Nordics for hydro and free cooling, the Gulf states for cheap energy and sovereign capital, and Malaysia's Johor Corridor as an overflow for Singapore, which froze new data center approvals over grid strain. The deep point is that an AI campus is now sited the way an aluminium smelter or a chlor-alkali plant is sited. You put it where the cheap, abundant, fast power is, and you accept whatever else comes with that location, because power availability dominates every other variable, including latency and proximity to users. That is a profound inversion. For the cloud era, data centers chased network and population. For the AI era, they chase electrons. And it feeds directly into the next constraint, because once you have chosen your power-rich site, the question becomes how you actually secure those electrons, which is where my co-lecturer takes the grid.
I'll take the efficiency metrics, because they are how operators talk and how an interviewer will test you. Start with power usage effectiveness, PUE, the ratio of total facility power to the power that actually reaches the computing equipment. If a hall draws 100 units and 90 reach the servers, while 10 go to cooling, conversion losses, and lighting, the PUE is about 1.11. A perfect, unreachable score is 1.0. The global fleet average has plateaued around 1.55 to 1.58 since roughly 2020, but the best hyperscale campuses run near 1.1 or better. And a genuine irony, the shift to liquid actually improves PUE, because moving heat with liquid spends far less overhead energy than moving it with air. The candid caveat, PUE is gameable. You can flatter it by excluding certain conversion losses or by measuring on a cool day. So treat any single advertised figure as directional and partly a marketing number. The metric that matters more in 2026 is water usage effectiveness, WUE, liters of water consumed per kilowatt hour of compute, mostly through evaporative cooling. The fleet average sits around 1.8 to 1.9 liters per kilowatt hour. Leaders like Microsoft report fleet WUE near 0.3. This is now a siting constraint, not a footnote. Roughly two-thirds of new United States hyperscale campuses since 2022 reportedly sit in high or extreme water stress counties, and AI cooling load has multiplied several fold since then. The response is closed-loop, zero-water evaporation designs. Microsoft is piloting these at its Phoenix and Mount Pleasant builds in 2026, which trade water for electricity, since a dry cooler rejects heat with fans and chillers instead of evaporation. That trade-off is the whole game, and it hands the baton to my co-lecturer, because electricity is the constraint behind every other constraint.
I'll take the power bottleneck, the core argument of this episode, and the claim is blunt. Electricity, land, and grid interconnection, not chips, are increasingly the gating inputs to AI. Start with scale. Global data center electricity is projected to exceed roughly 1,000 terawatt hours by the end of 2026, comparable to the entire annual consumption of Japan. In the United States, data center demand is estimated to roughly double from around 80 gigawatts, GW, billion watt units, in 2025 toward 150 gigawatts by 2028, almost all of it AI, which is the equivalent of adding dozens of full-size power plants in 3 years. And here is the wall, the grid interconnection queue. To plug a large new load or generator into the grid, you file a request. The utility studies whether transmission and substations can take it, and that request joins a queue that, as of 2025, had ballooned past roughly 1,500 gigawatts of pending capacity in the United States, with new connections in the major data center hubs facing waits of 4 to 7 years. You can take delivery of a building full of Blackwell racks in months. Energizing them can take half a decade. Worse, the heavy iron is itself scarce. Large power transformers now carry lead times reported around 2.5 years and stretching, by some accounts, toward 4 to 5 for the largest units. Generator step-up demand is up well over 200% since 2019, and the chain is throttled upstream by grain-oriented electrical steel, high-voltage bushings, and on-load tap changers, each served by a handful of qualified suppliers. High-voltage switchgear runs months. Industry analysts now estimate that close to half of planned United States data center builds this year face delay or cancellation, and the cause is rarely the chips. It is the transformer, the switchgear, and the queue.
I'll continue on power, because the response to that wall is the most important strategic shift in the sector. Operators have stopped waiting for the public grid. The first move is behind-the-meter generation, building your own power on-site, electrically behind the utility meter, to beat the queue entirely. The fastest path is on-site gas, turbines installed next to the campus, and Meta and Elon Musk's XAI both rushed gas generation in precisely to avoid multi-year waits. XAI's Colossus site in Memphis is the poster child, self-generating to stand up hundreds of thousands of graphics processors fast. Roughly 30% of anticipated new capacity is now projected to come from on-site generation, up from essentially zero a year prior, a reversal of a century-long assumption that big industrial loads simply plug into the grid. But the turbines are their own choke point. GE Vernova's gas turbine backlog has stretched into the late 20s, with the company guiding that reservations may be effectively sold out through 2030 by the end of 2026, and Mitsubishi and Siemens Energy similarly booked, so an on-site turbine slot is now as scarce as a grid connection. The second instrument is the Power Purchase Agreement, PPA, a long-term contract to buy electricity directly from a specific generator, locking price and supply. The third and the headline grabber is nuclear, including small modular reactors, SMR, factory-built reactors meant to deploy faster than a conventional plant. The deals are real. Microsoft's roughly 835-megawatt Three Mile Island restart under a 20-year PPA, Google with Kairos Power, Amazon backing X Energy and its Susquehanna campus, and Meta contracting across TerraPower, Oklo, Vistra, and Constellation for multiple gigawatts. By mid-2026, every major hyperscaler had signed nuclear. But note the timeline. The first restart electrons arrive around 2027, and most SMR units land in the 30s. The signal is unmistakable. The most sophisticated technology firms on Earth have concluded the gating input to AI is power, and they are now in the business of procuring generation.
I'll take the CapEx supercycle, because it is what ties this physical story to the money and the demand signal for the entire chain. Capital expenditure here means spending on long-lived physical assets, buildings, chips, power, cooling, and the AI build-out has triggered an extended, unusually large surge in it. I'll frame these carefully. The dossier and the sources flag them as investor guidance, not booked results, so treat them as the company's own forecasts. Combined big tech CapEx for 2026 is widely reported in the range of roughly $600 to $725 billion, up from somewhere around $350 to $500 billion in 2025, with roughly three quarters tied directly to AI infrastructure.
By company, as reported ranges, Amazon around $200 billion, up from roughly $125 billion. Alphabet around $175 to $185 billion, up from about $91 billion. Meta around $115 to $135 billion, up from roughly $72 billion. And Microsoft around $110 to $120 billion, up from about $90 billion. Layered on top are the lab-driven greenfield mega projects. The OpenAI, Oracle, and SoftBank Stargate program headlined at a $500 billion ambition, with the flagship Abilene, Texas campus, built by Crusoe and Lancium, topping out toward 1.2 gigawatts. The reason this is the single most watched number in the sector is that hyperscaler CapEx is the demand pulse for everything we have built across these episodes. When these firms raise guidance, TSMC, NVIDIA, the high-bandwidth memory makers, and the power and cooling vendors all respond. The stress signal worth flagging, big tech issued roughly $100 billion of bonds in early 2026 to fund this, and investors bought record credit default swap protection against them, an early bubble tremor we treat properly next episode. The CapEx print is the heartbeat, and it is increasingly financed, not self-funded.
I'll take the build versus lease decision and the mega projects, because that is what those CapEx dollars actually buy on the ground. A hyperscaler facing this demand has three procurement modes and runs all three at once. It can self-build, own the land, design, and construction, which gives maximum control and the best long-run economics, but is slow and ties up capital. It can take a powered shell from a wholesale developer and fit it out itself, trading some economics for speed and balance sheet relief. Or it can lease turnkey capacity from a colocation operator and simply move servers in. The reason the lease side has exploded is timing. When the constraint is the 4 to 7 year grid queue, a developer who pre-secured power and broke ground 2 years ago is selling something a hyperscaler physically cannot self-build fast enough, which is why powered shell pre-leasing now runs years ahead of construction, and why vacancy in the primary markets sits near record lows. Look at the scale of the self-builds to feel the shift. Meta's Prometheus cluster in Ohio is designed past 1 gigawatt and coming online through 2026, with its Hyperion campus in Louisiana scaling toward roughly 5 gigawatts over several years. xAI's Colossus reached on the order of 500,000 plus graphics processors and around 2 gigawatts, built in a famously compressed timeline by self-generating power. These are single sites approaching the electricity draw of a mid-sized city. And the financing increasingly blends modes. A hyperscaler signs a long-term lease, the developer raises project debt against that lease. Private equity and infrastructure funds like Blackstone, Digital Bridge, and KKR supply the equity, and the asset is structured almost like a toll road. The build-out is no longer a tech company expense line. It has become an infrastructure asset class.
Before the leasing tier, I'll surface the economics that hang over every dollar of this, because the dossier flags it as the central financial argument of the era, and you must be able to argue both sides. Two concepts. The first is depreciation, spreading an asset's cost over its useful life. The accounting question that matters is the assumed life of a graphics processor, and several hyperscalers recently extended their server depreciation schedules toward 5 or 6 years, which mechanically lowers reported annual cost and lifts profit. The bear case is that this is optimistic. NVIDIA now ships a new generation every year, Blackwell, Blackwell Ultra, then Rubin, and an accelerator 2 generations old is far less competitive on performance per watt. So if the true economic life is closer to 3 years, reported earnings overstate the real return. The second concept is return on invested capital, whether the profits these assets throw off exceed the enormous capital sunk into them. With $600 billion-plus flowing in annually, the honest answer is that it is genuinely contested. The bulls point to real, growing inference revenue, and to compute that sells out the moment it is energized. The bears point to the bond issuance, the credit default swap buying, and the circular financing where NVIDIA invests in the labs that buy NVIDIA hardware. You do not need to resolve it. You need to articulate it cleanly, because an interviewer raising AI bubble concerns is testing whether you can hold both the depreciation schedule risk and the demand is real rebuttal in the same answer. Keep that tension in mind as my co-lecturer maps the leasing tier, because the most leveraged, most contested balance sheets in this whole story live precisely in that layer of landlords and compute renters.
I'll take the layer the dossier flags as crucial and most often muddled, the co-location and leasing tier, which you must hold distinct from the cloud operators sitting above it.
the cleanest way to think about it. The cloud operator runs the computers and rents you compute as a service. The colocation layer is the landlord. It owns dirt, power, and cooling, and leases physical capacity to whoever brings the machines. Within that landlord layer, there are three sub-tiers worth naming precisely. First, interconnection or retail colocation, whose product is connectivity and dense cross-connects between many tenants. Equinix is the archetype, the meet-me room of the internet, now guiding toward roughly $10 billion of revenue in 2026 and investing $4 to $5 billion a year to roughly double capacity by 2029. Equinix's value is the network density inside the building, not raw megawatts. Second, the wholesale and hyperscale developers, the powered shell landlords, who lease very large single-tenant footprints by the megawatt to one hyperscaler at a time. Digital Realty, the public REIT, at around $6.5 billion in 2026 revenue, alongside privately held Vantage, QTS, now owned by Blackstone, CyrusOne, CoreSite, Switch, Aligned, Compass, and Stack Infrastructure. A powered shell, by the way, is exactly that, a building with power, water, and structure delivered, but the racks and fit-out left to the tenant. Third, the AI greenfield specialists, building bespoke, behind-the-meter, liquid-cooled campuses for a single AI customer. Crusoe is the marquee name there, the Stargate builder. The distinction matters for the interview. An REIT like Equinix or Digital Realty is a real estate and power business, earning a lease spread, structurally different from a CoreWeave-style neocloud renting graphics processors, or from Amazon, Microsoft, and Google renting software services. Same campus, three different businesses, three different risk profiles. Landlord, compute renter, and cloud operator.
I'll close by stacking the building on the chain we have been climbing and pointing at what comes next. Run the dependency chain one more time, and the shape of the constraint is unmistakable. You can fabricate a Blackwell die, package it, stack the high-bandwidth memory, and wire 72 of them into an NVL72, and still not turn the building on, because you are waiting 18 months for a transformer, 4 years for grid interconnection, a turbine slot booked into the 30s, and a CDU from a vendor that just got acquired. The frontier moved from the die to the package in the last episode. This episode it moves again, out of the silicon entirely, and into electrons, copper, water, and concrete. And notice the financial texture beneath it. The depreciation life of a graphics processor is genuinely contested. NVIDIA now ships a generation every year, Blackwell, then Blackwell Ultra, then Rubin. So if the real economic life is shorter than the 5 or 6 year accounting life, returns are thinner than they look, which is exactly why the bond issuance and the credit default swap buying matter. We also drew the most important organizational map of the series, the landlord tier, Equinix and retail interconnection, Digital Realty and the powered shell developers and wholesale, Crusoe and AI Greenfield, sitting beneath the cloud and operator tier, distinct businesses too often blurred into one word, cloud. Hold that distinction, because it is where the next episode lives. Episode 5 climbs into industry economics and geopolitics. Why hyperscalers design their own silicon, even while buying NVIDIA's. How the model labs underwrite this entire build-out with multi-gigawatt commitments. The CUDA software moat, the circular financing that worries the bubble watchers, and the export controls and Taiwan concentration that turn this whole supply chain into an instrument of statecraft. We have built the machine and powered the building. Next, we follow the money and the power, the political kind.